Hello, everybody. Mark Carlson here, SNEA Technical Council Chair. Welcome to the STC Podcast. Every week, the STC Podcast presents important technical topics to the developer community. Each episode is hand-selected by the SNEA Technical Council from the presentations at our annual Storage Developer Conference. The link to the slides is available in the show notes at snea.org/podcast. You are listening to STC Podcast Episode 46. Today we hear from Paul Luce, Principal Engineer Intel, and Chandra Kumar Konapi, Senior Software Engineer with Microsoft, as they present Building on the NVM Programming Model, a Windows Implementation, from the 2016 Storage Developer Conference.
All right, so we're going to talk about NVML, which a lot of you folks probably already know about, but believe it or not, we're moving it to Windows now, so we're going to have a Windows version of NVML. My name is Paul Luce. I'm a software engineer at Intel. Have been there over 20 years. Most of it doing storage software stuff. Recognize a few folks here in the room. I did a lot of the early NVM Express work. If you're familiar with the Open Fabrics Alliance Windows driver, I was the chair of that first working group, and there were a team of four or five of us that wrote that and put that on initially, so it's good to see that still plugging along and cruising. And I took a little time off and did some OpenStack Swift work, and now I'm back on this Windows NVML implementation with my partner in crime over here, Chandra.
I'm Chandra, working in NTFS, and I worked on enabling DAX file system mode in NTFS, and Neil, if you're familiar with Neil. And I also worked with Paul for moving NVML to Windows.
And I think we've got to manually click.
Sure.
All right, so let's talk about what we're going to talk about. This is more of sort of a high-level talk. We wanted to give you guys an overview on really what we're doing in Windows land. NVML as a library, as a lot of you probably know, has been around for a couple of years, following on the programming model. So for an agenda today, we of course have to do some level setting of the programming model. Hopefully some of you were here earlier for Doug's talk or many other talks, or Andy's talk yesterday, or sticking around for Andy's talk afterwards. And there's lots of deep dive stuff on the programming model. We're just going to kind of remind you what it is and where it's relevant when we talk about NVML, the library. And then of course we need to talk about NVML, the library itself. This is not a deep dive talk on the library. There are other talks that you can hear about the library. Or you can talk to any of us afterwards. Like I said earlier, we're really here to focus on the fact that we're doing this for Windows and give you some idea of what that means. Who's involved, what kind of process we're following, some of the architectural decisions that we had to make early on, how are we going to approach this, and of course a status on where we're at, right, and when we're going to be done, when you can actually use this library in Windows. So that's what we hope to get out of today, and if we do our jobs correctly, you guys will all walk away being experts on everything on this outline. There will be a quiz. Okay, so it doesn't say SNEA NVM Programming Model, SW, but it does say open, so that's close. It doesn't say the Intel Programming Model. So the SNEA NVM Programming Model, probably no news here to anybody in the room, started back, I don't know, what, 4 years ago? 4 or 5 years ago? Right, lots of companies put forth the specification, the links down below, and as Doug talked about in the last talk, it's not an API, right? It's a programming model specification. So let's keep plugging forward. And very similar slide to at least 16 other presentations floating around out there. Couple of small tweaks that we made for the Windows side about what we're going to go through. We'll just sort of highlight the main three paths that show up in this version of the slide. Of course, your traditional application through the file system down through your NVDIMM driver. We've got your second path through with the application through a PM-aware file system. And in Windows, it's also called DAX. Windows uses the term storage class memory to refer to persistent memory. So you may see SCM floating around in our slides. But DAX is the implementation. And involves NTFS today, and the cache manager, and the memory manager. Chandra did a lot of that work himself personally, so if you have any really hard questions for him, that'd be awesome. And then really the focus of this talk is the third path, the application direct path is what we call it, And that's, of course, where once you've gone through the control mechanisms of the file system, you've done your file mapping, you've got everything set up, and you've got load store access to memory, now you've got direct access to your hardware. So QNVML. Oh, well, first let's talk about the status of OS enablement of the programming model itself. So I'm not sure how many people know, but Windows has persistent memory support right now. It's available in all Windows SKUs, starting with the anniversary update and Server 2006, specifically within TFS with DAX mode. But you can do everything on Windows today that you can do on Linux. And then on Linux support, we heard it was somewhere around 4.4, but we don't know, we're Windows guys, so could have been earlier, could have been later. Somebody here probably knows better. And then both of these referred to the JEDEC-defined NVDIMN devices. Okay, also something that maybe a lot of folks don't know, and I'll talk more about our Windows community a little bit later. It's not just an Intel-Microsoft thing. We've got a couple other companies involved, and we're beating the bushes trying to get more. But HP Enterprise is doing some stuff above and beyond what Microsoft has done for NVM support, specifically around Workstation 2012 R2. So they've got the ability to provide early access to NVM technologies in this older OS without any kernel changes from Microsoft. So these are kernel mode drivers that HP Enterprise has provided and able to provide access for the Workstation folks. So one real specific thing, there's no DAX file system support. Like I said, Microsoft is not behind these changes. But this does use a subset of NVML based on the work that we're doing on the Windows side. And we've got a lot more information that you can get out of this link here, and these slides are posted. So if you want to learn how to do some early access NVM stuff with releases prior to 2016, then you can follow that link and get them. Okay, so now NVML, and I think this is probably maybe the third time this slide has been up today, or at least something very similar. So hopefully everybody knows the NVML library is something that was created not to implement the persistent programming model, the SNIA persistent programming model, but to assist, right? So it's there to help application developers better take advantage of this programming model. Okay, so it really came out of input that we had heard on common pain points out in the industry from various customers that we were talking to. And we're going to go through some of those details, exactly what it does. But involves, of course, hardware abstraction, making things easier. There's some value-added functionality for application developers that aren't used to dealing with transactions or required atomicity, things that used to be dealt with by the file system or somebody beneath them that they didn't care about. And then some performance improvements as well. Or performance enhancements over maybe standard ways of doing this. Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to Chandra now, and he's going to go through several of the NVML libraries and show you a couple of examples of what they look like under Windows.
Thank you, Paul. Okay, NVM libraries. So it is just a set of convenience libraries that work on top of open NVM programming model to solve the common problems for application developers. So that is the way to look at it, one way. So it is in user space, for now at least. And it is not a single library. It's a bunch of library, as I initially said. There is one core library which does the trivial functionalities like PMM persist to make sure that the data that we store is persisted, and testing whether a region is backed by persistent memory, like directly backed by persistent memory, such functionalities. And there are other libraries, as you can see, that libpmm obj, block, log, they depend on the core library and provide more advanced support. I mean, each one has a key focus, like pmm log will provide logging APIs, etc. And again, this adds value on top of DAX file system, as we can see, and it's a user mode library. Okay, let's now look at each library and what's the key focus point. So PMEM is again the core library that is going to provide functionalities like flushing or persisting the data that is written, testing whether the region is DAX mapped or not. It's a core and every other library depends on that one. PMEM block, this provides block atomicity. if applications are used to or rely on sector atomicity, maybe this is something that might help those applications. Because it doesn't provide generic transactional support, just an atomicity at a, whether a block is written or not, this is more efficient than other transactional libraries. And PMMlog provides APIs for logging on a persistent memory. Like you create a file, log file, and keep appending to it on a persistent memory. That's PMMlog if you, for applications that need them. And PMMobj, this one library might be the one you, most of you need, or most of the app developers need, because this provides generic transactional support. We will see the challenges later, and then see more into what I mean by generic transactional support. Maybe you already heard from other talks, like Paul said. And but this is the one that most of you might need. And we have vmem and vmalloc. This essentially provides a virtual memory from a persistent memory. We think it is little, I don't know, we see less interest here. So if you believe that you might be needing this functionality, please give us feedback. So these are the group of libraries and their overview.
And you know, some of you experts out there might be saying, but wait, isn't there more? I was out on GitHub and I saw more than just this. And yeah, there is. So the point is the scope of what we're doing in the Windows side is limited, and we're behind where the Linux side is at because, of course, we're 2 years behind in development. But I'll talk more about that in a minute. But if you look out on GitHub and see like a remote persistent memory library, this it's not a mistake that it's not here. It is there for Linux. It's just not there for Windows.
Okay. So with DAX file system, the efficient way or efficient path is to memory map a file and then do load or store directly on the PMM device. So now let's look at how the code looks like for this model. And I think this is the open programming model, if you already heard that. So we create a file or open a file. We create a file mapping object. Then we map a view of a file. Then we load or store on the view directly. Whenever we access the view, we are actually accessing the persistent device. So that's why it is efficient. No OS software is in the way. And when we want to persist the data that we previously wrote, we use either flush view of file or flush file buffers, depending on we need the metadata of the file to be persisted or not. So flush file buffers will persist the, all dirty data associated with that file and the metadata. So it is less efficient than flush view of file if all an application needs is to persist a given region. So generally, applications might prefer to use flush file buffers less often than flush view of file. You can model your application accordingly. So this is the overview. And this doesn't need a DAX file system. This model that we see here, this piece of code, it works on any file system, even non-DAX file system as well. It just works. But this is the efficient path in case of DAX file system. That is where we're looking at it.
So Chandra, what's the granularity of the flush operations here?
Can you come again, Paul?
Are we flushing on cache line? Are we flushing on pages?
Oh, okay. So this flush view of file, it's a good question. So the intention of flush view of file is to make sure that the data that is there in the virtual memory goes to the disk all the way to the disk through the I/O system that OS provides. So it works on the page granularity. We have to flush the page, write the page out to the file, which is on disk. That is the intended operation of the flush view of file. And flush file buffers, it flushes all the pages corresponding to the file. Also, it makes sure that the logs that are written, which is still in volatile memory, gets persisted. So that if you extend a file and then write to it, when you call flush file buffers, it makes sure that the file size is also persisted and the data. If the file size is not persisted, even if we persist the data, it is immaterial. We are not able to going to read it back. So does it answer the question, Paul?
I have another question, though.
Sure. It's easy to say.
So you're saying we're going to flush a page for doing 18 bytes, but you also say it's not atomic. What does that mean?
Thank you. Yeah. Here, we are writing more than 8 bytes, and it's not really atomic. By that, what I mean is, if the machine crashes after this string copy, sorry, maybe I should speak in the microphone. Machine crashes after the string copy, part of the string could be persisted and part is not, based on what cache lines are flushed. See, we are looking at only this thread. Maybe there is some other thread operating on the same file, and then it is issuing a flush after the string copy. And though our flush is not executed, part of the string could make it to the disk, while others are still sitting in the cache lines, which doesn't reach the memory and thereby the disk. So that's what I meant by the atomic operation. Is it?
That's a bummer. I wonder what we're going to do about that.
Okay, so does the problem make sense? Okay, so I conveniently assume that the problem makes sense, and let's move on. So first, let's see how libvimum is going to fit here. As you can see, most of the code remains the same, the create file mapping, map view of file, all same, except for how we persist the data. Previously, we were using flush view of file. Here, we are using vimum persist. And why vimum persist? That's a question. So in DAX, we know that the region is DAX mapped. That is, we are directly writing to the persistent memory. And all we need to do is flush the cache data that is there in the browser cache. And that would take care of persisting it. And vimum persist just does that. Sorry, yeah, it just do that. Flushes the browser cache to make sure the data reaches the DIM, which is enough to make sure it persists. Unlike the flush view of file, it has to issue an IO for the page, which is there in the volatile memory, through the IO path to reach the disk, which is two different operations altogether. It's just that both provide the same guarantee in case of DAX, but this is much efficient. So that's why we would suggest or prefer to use vimum persist. And again, as we can still see, the string copy is more than 8 bytes, and even in this case, it is not atomic, meaning that if the machine crashed after the sheer copy, but before we persist, part of the string could have been flushed from the cache to the DIM, and part is not. So we'll still have the open problem. And the picture here, yeah, you have a question?
So in the previous case, there is no, the file system is not VM aware.
It may or may not be. Okay, the question is, in this case, if the file system is PMM aware, will there be a mapping into memory? The question assumes if there is a mapping into a volatile memory and copying data. No, there is no copy of the data. Okay. The mapping is created such that the virtual region directly points to the physical persistent media. So we don't have another copy. Okay, the question is, can't flush view of file be enlightened to detect that the region that you are flushing is backed by a persistent memory, it's a DAX file system, and then work optimally? So to do that, we need a check. So given a region, we need to check whether it is DAX-backed, DAX-mapped, or regular memory mapped. And that is a little costly as well. We need to make a call into kernel mode to detect whether this region is DAX mapped or not. It needs a kernel switch. From user mode to, we need to switch to kernel mode and then get that info back.
Yeah, those are the two key differences, right, is the context switch. And if you remember on the previous slide, we talked about being page granular. We're flushing a page. This is the next slide. So besides not having a kernel mode transition here, this is cache line granularity. So those are the two big differences between those two cases. We've actually, Chandra will show you a little performance demo in a minute about what the impact is on doing it one of those two ways.
Okay, so thank you, Paul. That's a good point, those two things. And these are the reasons why we prefer vimum persist, primarily efficient. And one way to think about it is, they both are for different purpose altogether. This is just to flush the browser caches, and this other thing has to make sure that it has to issue an IO for the page to be returned to disk. It's just work for DAX mode as well, that's it. And now, this picture is again reminding us that libvimum is a value add and top of the DAX file system support that is provided with OS. Just as a reminder.
But still not atomic?
Yeah, still not atomic, yeah. So again, the OS, as we discussed, if the OS crashes in between, based on what cache lines are flushed, part of the string can make it to the DIM and other part might not. So that's the state. Okay. Now, so here we see that libvimum obj, where it fits, and what a little overview. This is the library that most of you might again need. That's why we are dedicating a slide to this library. And it depends on libvimum, and which depends on the DAX file system support, that is the layering. And it provides generic transactional support. Like you say, begin a transaction, allocate memory, and then end the transaction. You might ask why we need a transaction for allocating memory. So, or you might already have guessed why we need that. Just to reiterate, when we allocate a memory from persistent memory or persistent heap, once the memory is allocated, heap loses that region that we allocated. And we have to assign the address to a persistent variable or a variable that will be persisted. And later we can use it in the same instance of the application, or if the machine reboots, even after that, we can reach the region from the variable which has the address. If the machine were to crash after we allocate and before we assign it to a variable, we essentially lose the region. It is neither in the heap, nor we have a reference to it to reach it. So this is the problem. This is one of the challenges of programming with persistent memory. So we need a transaction such that once we allocate and before we assign it to a variable, if the machine were to crash, it has to be rolled back and given back to the heap. So that's why we need the transaction support. And let's see more about this libmemo mods. OK. So here we see we are back to our string example, which Paul was rightly questioning, why still not atomic, still not atomic. It's a good question, and we have an answer here. So this is how it looks like using libmemoj. We use txbegin and txend to indicate begin and end of the transaction, and within that, we use txmemcopy to copy a region of memory into the buffer. And this is atomic, meaning if the machine has to crash, even when you're halfway through the copy, it won't be like part of the string. It will be either all or nothing. Libmemoj takes care of it for us, like writing a log record and then rolling back in case of a crash. All is taken care. So yeah, and we might not need to use txmemcopy. We can use regular string copy as well. This is not a requirement, or we can use any load or store instructions. But before modifying a region, say if you're modifying 10 bytes of a buffer that we allocated, we have to add the region into the transaction so that libmemoj can roll it back. We say that, OK, this region is going to be modified, and then we modify the region. So in case of a crash, we can roll back to the original state. OK. And the picture below is a peek into how objects are allocated and used using libmemoj, so that it helps with the next slide that we are going to see. Whenever we allocate an object, we get an OID, an object identifier, which is essentially a pair of the pool that we allocated, or you can assume it's a root object or something like that, a pool that we allocated, and a relative offset of this object. Just again, a reminder that this being persistent memory, which can be, that is, a file is DAX mapped, it can be unmapped, and the application can be closed. Later again, when it is mapped, it can be mapped to a different virtual address. So we can't uniquely identify an object with a pointer. That wouldn't be sufficient. So we always need a relative offset from beginning of something which is unique. So you can simply assume that it's a pair of the pool object comma the relative offset. That's the object ID. And that is how allocations are made using libmemoj. And that's what this picture is trying to tell us. OK. Now again, the string copy is atomic. We've already solved one problem. And the code doesn't look much complex other than macros, which is unknown, maybe.
Mm-hmm. There are still 18 characters.
Oh, sorry, one moment. Just click on the little red thing.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
You're going to pass 18.
Yeah.
So whenever you are going to flush, you're going to flush the size of the page.
That is with flush view of files. That is
so
true.
If PMEM persist?
So PMEM persist is cache line aligned, 8 bytes. So yeah.
It might help just to say a few more words about this, because we don't have any actual real application code in here. But this is meant to be the application, if that's not obvious. It's just that all we're showing are macros that are implemented by the library, right? So the library gives you this macro and this macro and this macro, and you can put any number of operations inside of those two macros and have them be treated as a transaction. And in this case, txmemcopy will eventually, internally, the library resolve to a PMEM persist that we saw a minute ago.
Sure. Could you come again?
I don't know.
I'm
Andy, you want to help us out?
Yeah, sure.
So, despite its name, hardware transactional memory is about visibility, not persistence. So hardware transactional memory doesn't cover everything. So it doesn't solve this problem. This problem is about making something atomic in the face of power.
Sure. But I mean, you know, this is about atomicity. This is not about persistence. There's two different aspects.
Well, this is atomicity, both thread and persistence.
Yes, Andy.
So on that macro, there's two types of atomicity being provided. The begin macro itself provides power fail atomicity, and the lock that it takes provides a runtime, you know, multi-thread and hardware transactional memory really provides one of them.
Cool. Thanks, Andy. you know where to find him.
Okay, so in the last slide, we discussed that we need not use the macros. We can use regular string copy or assignments as well. This slide will shed more light on that one. So this is just a singly linked list insertion. The singly linked list is on persistent memory. That's the case we are going to see. So, okay, so this line, let me first walk through. We again have transaction begin, TX begin, and TX end, just similar. And here we are allocating a region out of persistent memory. And we are adding data to the node that we allocated. And we're fixing the next pointer to be the next of the root points. And finally, we are changing the root. This is when we are touching the existing variable, root's head, to the new pointer that we just allocated, new node that we just allocated. And these are all the new node. Here, all the three lines, we are updating the new node. So if the transaction were to abort, there is nothing to worry about. If the new node went back to the heap, we are all good. So we made allocation, we are updating the new node, and if it goes back to the heap, we are all good. Whereas here, we are updating the root object, which is an existing object. So before updating it, we need to make sure that we say, hey, this region, the root node, is being updated to the added to the transaction. That's what we are doing here. And then we change the root's head so that in case of a crash after that, before the transaction could commit, we know how to roll back. And this TXALOC, this takes care of allocating memory from the heap, and in case of an abort, it will give it back to the heap. It will roll back what it did. So this is kind of safe, and it doesn't have the problem that we previously thought, that leak.
You know, one other thing that's probably worth pointing out here, Chandra, if you weren't going to go through it, is these macros here.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Do you want me to cover those? Or?
Yes, Paul. I mean,
so I'm not sure if any of you saw in Doug's talk or if you attended Andy's thing yesterday, one of the problems with persistent memory programming is finding your stuff after you've gone through a reset or a reboot, right? Where do you find things? And the notion of relative pointers versus absolute pointers, and even closing your application and reopening it, you could get a different base for whatever you've mapped. So what this is showing is how the NVML solves that problem with these object identifiers, right? So you as an application developer reference all of your objects through object identifiers and macros like this one, which I think would stand for dereference read write, right? So you basically pass this macro one of those object identifiers, and it essentially converts it to a pointer. So then you can use standard notation to then get to an element within that structure. So that's what those funny looking macros are doing in there, is using object identifiers to convert to more C style pointers. Any questions on any of that?
I was expecting that someone will question, why don't we speak about lock? Do you want to speak about it as well?
Well, actually, Andy sort of covered that in answering the question about hardware transactions, but maybe some people might not have heard without the mic. Right, that the TX begin, this is actually two things in one, TX begin lock. There's a TX begin macro that is just there for power fail atomicity, but we've got this macro that also adds a lock in where you pass in the lock to handle multi-thread atomicity. So really that lock is protecting you in two ways, or that macro is protecting you in two ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's a convenience variant for TX begin and TX begin, basically. The lock will be released when the transaction commits or aborts. It will be acquired in the beginning. OK, So we briefly discussed that we will be seeing the performance comparison of PIM and Persist and Flash View of File. Here is the demo that Toby shared in IDF. Toby is our DAX and NVML PM in Microsoft. And here we are writing 64 bytes at random offset, and after every 64 write, we issue a flush. And we're just measuring the perf of those operations. Once with flush view of file, and another time with PIM and persist. And the latency is almost 4 times better. The detailed info of each operation, that is write versus flush, is in a different XML, because this tool lists everything. This is an internal tool, and it lists the details in an XML. But we still get an overview that just by changing the operations, your latency improved by like 4 times.
And you can probably see you can see these in back, but the IOPS as well, mm-hmm. right? So there's flush view of file at 1.3 million, and there's PM persist at 2.9 million. And that's because of the two things that we mentioned earlier, the no transition needed here, and primarily this is page granularity.
So there's no user to kernel switch. PIM and persist is more granular. And the other thing which is, again, I would like to mention is they both are for different purpose. PIM and persist just flushes the cache lines, and because that's what it's need in DAX world or DAX environment. Whereas flush view of file, it's totally different requirement. We have to make sure that the page that is there in volatile memory reaches disk, which is way different from PIM and persist. And yeah. And one more thing, though it is not related to this performance comparison, libpmm has variations for memcopy, and it does the optimal, it uses optimal instructions for based on the size of the region that we are going to copy to. For example, it will know, should I use regular copy and then flash, or it will prefer non-temporal store based on the region size and many other factors. And even the PIMM persist depends on the processor. It can use the best instruction available in that processor, supported by that processor. Okay. Overall, I think this is what, I showed a bunch of slides, but this is what we wanted to convey. For DAX, the efficient path is to use memory mapped and then load and store instructions. And NVML will be very convenient to use that model of programming with DAX. We already saw one problem with persistent memory, and when you get into it, you might reach many other problems, and this will be very handy. And we also want you to know that pmm.io is a place where you get more details about NVML. I think, yeah. And libpmmobj is one of the most required library for general application developers. And I'll hand it over to Paul to walk through how we have been doing this.
Okay, yeah, this is kind of a fun part too. So we're gonna step back from the technical stuff a little bit and talk about sort of how we're organized, what we're doing, what tools we're using, who we are. It's awesome how far we've come in just a few months. And you know, a lot of us have worked in open source communities before, and we're definitely calling this a community. This is not a couple of companies collaborating. We're still very small, but this is very reminiscent for me of when we did the NVM Express driver for Windows. It was initially just 3 companies and I think, I don't know, 5 or 6 of us that had to work under NDA for a few months. But as soon as we got that restriction lifted, we were wide open to build our community, to pick our tools, our communications methods, our ground rules. We were able to just establish everything, starting with just that small handful of people. And it's still going strong today with a gazillion people involved, still using many of the same processes that we started years ago. So I kind of see us doing that right now. We started from scratch. It was just basically me and Chandra, and we've got many more people involved, I'll mention here in a minute. And we've got some tools put together, and we've got some things that are growing and some communication stuff that we're doing. So we're going to kind of share that with you of where we're at, and hopefully that we'll be as big as the OFA Windows group is in a couple of years from now. So right now, the community is HP Enterprise, HP Labs, Intel, and Microsoft. And we'd love to add more companies to that list. And we've still got a lot of work to do, so there's definitely no shortage. We are a time zone friendly group, even though there's maybe 12 of us total right now. Almost everybody's in a different time zone, right? We've got Texas, Washington, Arizona, Poland, Brazil, Taiwan, California. We're just all over the place. So a small group, but widely dispersed, so we're able to take in new developers from pretty much any geo. Our goal right now is to be code complete by the end of this year. And what that means really is getting all of the framework ported, all of the testing framework. Right, so a big part of this project, since it's open source, is the ability to do automated unit testing, automated system and functional testing as much as possible, so that every time anybody new comes in and touches the code, we know that it's fully regressed before it goes into the database. So obviously all that has to get done on Windows before we can actually start making changes to the library, other than the core stuff that makes it functional, that people might be interested Windows specific. So that's what we meant by code complete. We want everything to be working. We won't necessarily have added any new value or anything that Windows people might specifically want. Somebody raise their hand back there? No?
Yeah. Go back one slide. Slide 16. So your first objective there, maintaining identical APIs for all OSs, was kind of an explicit non-goal when this started.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out, SW. I should have worn my glasses. I totally skipped this entire four bullets. And they're really important, and that's one of the reasons, because it was specifically mentioned, especially in Doug's talk, about avoiding APIs. This is not a programming model. This is a library, right? So we do talk about APIs, and we do have to define the APIs. And one of the first decisions that we made, obviously with significant input from Microsoft, because this is a Windows library, was that we wanted zero changes in the API. I mean, absolutely identical, down to the function prototype, down to whether it's camel case or not. I mean, we want it exactly the same. So as an application developer using NVML, if you want to write your application for Windows or Linux, the signatures are spot on. You won't see a single difference. And so far, we've been able to maintain that. And I don't see any reason why we're not going to be able to maintain that moving forward. But that's definitely a goal of the library, because it's an implementation. Which, of course, means maximizing our shared code and documentation. And I'll show you our directory structure layout here in a minute, so you can sort of see where things are falling out and know that, you know, nothing up our sleeves. It actually is laid out this way. We use the same repository. So if you go to GitHub today, pmm.io, go poking around the source code, you're looking at the Windows code, too. We're working in real time off the same code. It's just when the Linux stuff is released, none of the Windows-specific things are tagged. We don't have a Windows-specific release tagged, and we're not building Windows-specific releases right now. But all of the source and the work-in-progress stuff on test code is available right now. Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. I don't know how I missed an entire section of that slide. Okay, so like I said, the fun part, right, starting a new community, jumping into a working community is really cool too, right, because if it's a good community, if it sucks, then it's no fun to work there. But, you know, for the most part, all your decisions are made, and you just got to learn how to work with the machinery that people are going and understand what's happening. But we got to start from scratch, right, we had to use GitHub because that's what the Linux library is in. The things that we're using that were already common there are GitHub. We use Reviewable for all of our code reviews. And then we have a homegrown test framework. I say mostly. I think it really is mostly homegrown. And it's a combination of Bash scripts and some Perl and some C code. There's got to be one other language in there somewhere. It's kind of this mesh of things, and it's really well structured. But it was not an original design goal to have it be multi OS. So one of the big decisions that we had to come up with when we started this effort, besides the API call, was what are we going to do about the test framework? It's not going to run under Windows. So we identified the maximum amount of shared code that we could possibly come up with and figured out how to wrap it in PowerShell. So we are converting basically everything that's Bash in the Linux side to PowerShell on the Windows side. And really everything else, including the Perl and, of course, the C code, is for the most part, untouched. Where we find incompatibilities in the C code, we will make every effort not to conditionally compile it out for Windows or conditionally compile in something else. We'll make an effort to refactor it so that it is using something common between the two OSs. Of course, we can't do that everywhere. So we do have a few conditional, you know, if def win32 kind of things floating around in the test code. Almost none of that in the library, though. That's almost all limited to test code. And then you'll see in a minute when we show the directory structure, there's some obvious things that are big chunks of code that have to be Windows, right? All of our threading, implementation, memory mapping, that kind of stuff that is just night and day different, has different different implementations behind the scenes. And then on Windows side, we're using Visual Studio, AppVare, which is our continuous integration build environment, which actually, I didn't even know this thing existed when we started doing this, so we weren't sure what we were gonna do for CI. But we do have a system now set up where we are integrated with GitHub. Reviewable was already integrated, and now AppVare is as well. So as a developer, you make your pull request, and you instantly get both the Linux library test being run under Travis CI and the Windows test being run under AppVare CI. And then you can see your results, and the maintainers can go through and look at all of the unit tests and make sure they're passing before they even bother jumping into Reviewable. So AppVare is pretty cool. And then Trello, I'll talk about that on the next slide. That's really one of our key tools that we can use because we're so small. As soon as we get to be a bigger community, then we'll probably drop that, but you'll see in a second why it's extremely helpful for what we're trying to do. Process-wise, again, because we're really small, we do have a weekly meeting, and it's very helpful because we're trying to move on a tight timeline, and we're trying to port over 160 tests, I think, plus a lot of the framework. The framework that's written in Bash. So we've got a lot of well-known tasks that we have to get done, so it helps to talk face-to-face. We've also got an IRC channel that we don't use a whole lot, again, because we're having weekly meetings, but when we stop having meetings, I think we'll find ourselves on IRC quite a bit more. And then the link below covers Trello, and we'll just go ahead and flip to the next slide, and you'll see what that looks like. So if you haven't used Trello before, it's super, super easy, basic way for anybody, for us we're using it as developers, but for anybody to collaborate where you've got pretty well-known tasks to deal with, right? So the way we run our weekly meeting is kind of going through this Trello board. Each one of these things is called a card, and we start off with our discussions column, so anybody in the community can throw out a discussion topic, and that just guarantees that we talk about it in the meeting, right? It doesn't mean that you can't talk about it before then. We've got email and IRC and all that stuff, but this is just a way to say, oh yeah, it's not important, but I want to make sure we talk about it next time. We've got sort of our wiki or reference page there, so we've got all sorts of cards on how to port certain things a certain way so that we're all doing things consistently. We've got a couple of columns for backlog, so we have generic backlog tasks, and we have backlog tasks that are focused around the tests that we're porting, so that we can get an idea of, we have to port the tests first, we don't want anybody touching code until it's testable. So we've got lots of tests to get through first before we start moving on to non-test related items. The next column is just our mirror of GitHub issues. We don't have any yet because we're not doing anything with importing test code. And then moving on down, we've got sort of doing and review and done and closed and all that kind of stuff. But this is kind of, you can see this is the agenda of how our workflow works in our community. We just go through one item by one item and see who's got roadblocks, who's questioning a certain implementation, how it should be converted. Has somebody hit this before? And so far, it's been working really well. I think this was before we had counters on here, but we're right now we've got about 150 backlog items completed, and probably about 80 more to go before that we know of, before we know that the test code has been completely ported, and then we'll deal with whatever issues arise and whatever else we need to do specific to Windows. All right, like I said, I was gonna dump out the directory structure here that you'd get if you went off to and cloned the repo and looked at it locally. So these are all the Linux libraries here, which are now the Linux and Windows libraries. And then in the common directory, which originally was intended for code that was common between the libraries, it's now has two meanings. It's code that's common between the libraries and between the OSs that the library supports. So we've got a few Windows-specific things down here. You can see we've got our pthread implementation for Windows is down here. And then we've also got, we're going to migrate this over. We've got this sort of leftover Windows directory up at the root. We're going to slowly migrate that all over into this common area. So basically the layout will be all one directory structure regardless of the OS, and there'll be a few Windows-specific files floating in the common area, and that's it. So everything else is untouched. And the way we laid out our Visual Studio solution, we've got our main solution at the top, which includes individual projects for everything related to the library. So we've got right now five or six library projects, right, to build the actual libraries. at least a handful of internal tools that are used by the tests, or even one or two tools that can be used by developers that are built as separate projects. And then we have this nice long laundry list of sub-projects. Each one contains a suite of tests specific to an area of functionality. So each one of those can be anywhere from one test to 30 tests, depending on what unit of functionality we're trying to test with it. But that's how we—that's essentially how we build and debug all of the test framework in the library and all the libraries as well. To date, neither Chandra or anybody else on the team has really had to make hardly any changes to the library. It's really been all changes to the test code. Part of that is because there was some prep work done by the maintainer of the entire library up front when he knew that Windows was coming. He changed some of the library to make it a little bit more friendly for Windows, not Windows specific, but he made those changes in advance. So really we've been really again just focused on getting this test code ready so we can start with real implementations. Okay, status and plan. Like I said, we're really active in development now. We have full meetings every week. We've got lots of pull requests going in every week, lots of reviews happening. I think out of 12 of us working on the code, there's probably 40 things in flight right now, either being worked on or in review, ready for the maintainer to kick back for a revision. We are nearing the end of implementing the test code, which we know is probably going to produce more backlog items for us once we get everything testable. And then our plans are to continue to maintain this whole thing on pmm.io. And we will start building the Windows version of NVML and providing that as a tagged, probably an MSI package or something on in the same repo. And then we've just got some of the references here. So that's kind of what we're doing, where we're at, and where we're going. And again, if anybody is interested, wants to help out, we've still got lots of work to do. All you got to do is contact me or Chandra. Both our contact information is on here, and we will get you going. Any questions? All right, one question.
Can you comment on support for other architectures?
Yeah, I think that question was asked once the other day too. The library is certainly built to handle other architectures, but nobody has brought forth a patch to support other architectures. So there's nothing in the architecture of the library that would prevent supporting anything else. But nobody's brought that forward, and if they do, it will be welcome with open arms. Yeah, it is. I'm not sure what the current status is, but Andy does.
Yeah, it's been picked up by Fedora, and it'll be in RHEL 7.3. It's a gross kind of precursor to that. It's in OpenSUSE, and then it'll be in one of the upcoming SLES things. We haven't submitted it yet to Debian. We have all the packaging stuff working. We just haven't finished some of the labor. So it's getting it on the Linux side.
Yeah, and on the Windows side, we'll continue to see closer and tighter integration with Microsoft as we, make it through the rest of this process. Okay, thanks everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you have questions about the material presented in this podcast, be sure and join our developers mailing list by sending an email to developers-subscribe@snea.org. Here you can ask questions and discuss this topic further with your peers in the developer community. For additional information about the Storage Developer Conference, visit storagedeveloper.org.